Welcome back to Railway Mania. Today we're going to be talking all about 009 narrow gauge modelling. So our guests for this episode are Ben Powell and Rob Rossington of the 009 Society. Following on from episode 12, where Dan Thomas and Pat James gave an overview of modelling narrow gauge in this scale, we're going to expand the subject and look at what's been going on in terms of new developments, as well as talking about what the Society has to offer. Ben, what do you do at the Society?
I am the trade liaison officer, which sounds a lot more exciting than it is. I just try and find out what is coming out in the narrow gauge modelling world, see what new models are coming out, and then also receive the pointers from members who say, oh, I've just found this, and I'll just put it out there and so the membership know about it.
Does that mean we can mine you for information on new releases?
You can try.
Ben gets all the interesting stuff.
And Rob, how about you? How are you involved with the 009 Society?
So I'm the secretary, which, unlike Ben's role, is exactly how it sounds. I essentially am the second port of call, I think, for the vast majority of members after Brian, who's the membership secretary. So my role is essentially looking after the Society's correspondence, making sure its records are up to date, and taking minutes of committee meetings and things like that, anything sort of official.
Can you just give me an overview of what are the aims of the 009 Society?
It's to promote narrow gauge modelling, help those who are interested find out what they want to know about it, really. So if you want how to start, how to build a narrow gauge layout, what narrow gauge is all about, and where you can get the materials, kits, and anything else you might need from. And if you want to develop your skills in that aspect, you know, we can point you in the right direction for that.
Well, what kind of benefits can you get from joining the Society?
So we've got our members' sales area, which I think is probably the first port of call for a lot of people who join. A service for members to sell to each other via the Society, and for the Society to sell its kits and things like that. After that, we've got our local area groups, which are a good place for people to meet like-minded modellers, get advice, get help, and just socialise, essentially. And then, obviously, we've got our monthly magazine, which is the news, which is always full of inspiration and tips and tricks, and Ben quite frequently writes in it with all the new products that are coming out and things like that. So there's quite a lot for the Society to offer.
Could you give me a little overview of like the history of the 009 Society? So where did this start, and what are the aims of the Society?
The Society was originally formed in 1973. It's kind of like most societies, really. It was just a group of blokes who got together, you know, who were narrow gauge enthusiasts and modellers, and decided to make it official, for want of a better word, really. And it's sort of that was after the 1960s introduction of N gauge and Egerbahn, stuff like that, and then P-code came along with the crazy track. It kind of all evolved from there, really, and it's sort of it's grown sort of quite a lot over the sort of the past 40, nearly 50 years. Obviously, so we had Egerbahn started off, and then you had the Mini Trains and GUF come along in the early 70s, and then other manufacturers got in, like the kit manufacturers, like Chivers 59s, who's now known as 579, and Dundas Models and all the rest. And it's a kind of snowballed in a way. And so the aim of Society is just to promote awareness, shall we say, the awareness of the modelling, of what you can do, what it's about, and where you can get the stuff from, really. And if you need help, it can, you know, generally point you in the direction that you need to go.
Like you say, it's a snowballed, and the take-up of the scale has been huge recently. I mean, when I first started modelling, I wouldn't have thought that you could get one day, like I think we said in the previous episode, that soon you'll be able to buy every single item of rolling stock from the Linton and Barnstaple Railway. That's it would have been unthinkable back then. I mean, all you had was like this Rodney Stenning kit in those days. How's that been for the Society? Have there been many new members coming off the back of the new ready-to-run releases?
I'd say there has been. The last few years, really, the last 5 or 10 years, the membership has increased quite substantially. So we're now up to about 2,500 members, which is pretty good going, to be fair.
Including me. I joined as well. I've just got my
excellent
my free kit that you get. I didn't even know you got a free kit. I would have joined ages ago if I'd known you get a free kit with it.
Oh, well, see, the free kits are a new thing. It's been in the past sort of few years where that started. Early this afternoon, when I was going through some of my stuff, I actually found my original membership card from 2001 when I first joined the Society.
Wow. If you can give me an idea of what kind of resources and support and services the Society provides. You say it's about awareness, but what does it do once you've joined?
I suppose the main one would be the member sales. That's kind of always a one that grabs people. Because, I mean, there's always stuff coming and going from there. And then, so that's obviously second-hand stuff. Yeah, there's our own society-produced kits as well, which is just rolling stock at the minute. And then, if you've got stuff you want to get rid of, it just goes to the member sales or anything like that. But then we do spare part services as well. So if you've got, I don't know, a chassis that's missing something or burned out motor or broken gear, you know, they can have a rummage through the stash and see what's in. Normally, we get a good number of exhibitions in during the year when circumstances allow. There's all the area groups as well. That's kind of the second/tied for first aspect of the society, is that there's area groups all over the country, you know, down south and in the Midlands and in the north. And I think they're trying to get something going in Scotland as well. I'm sure there's one or two in Wales.
Of course there's some in Wales.
I mean, it's got to be, really.
The spiritual home of Narrow Gauge.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, if you don't get in touch through one of the society links, like the spares service, if you go to a local group meeting, there'll be someone who can build or fix chassis, someone who knows scenic, someone who knows track lane and baseboard build and all the rest. So any sort of question or problem you could have, there'll generally be someone who can answer it for you and help.
The wealth of knowledge in the society is incredible, because one of the things I get a lot is emails from people asking, is there somebody that can help me with repairing the chassis, as Ben says, or anything like that? And there is always somebody that I can find that will be able to help, no matter how obscure the problem. There's always somebody.
And what kind of a team do you have working inside the society? How many people are sort of the active staff, I guess you could say?
Well, the committee, I suppose, yeah. It's about 12 of us, I think. Keep the society ticking over, really, and try and steer it in a way that we think, the membership will appreciate and it will benefit everyone.
Especially the aspect about finding spare parts for things, because that can become a nightmare. And actually, until recently, it was almost, I would say, a crisis for a lot of people, because a lot of these kits relied on old chassis that you couldn't get anymore. There weren't that many replacements available for them. And until the recent sort of eruption in readily available 009 chassis, we were all reliant on very, very old things, especially 040 chassis.
Yes, that was kind of, that's the thing that everyone wants and you can't get, really.
The Ibotren Cuckoo, yeah. I believe, was a popular one, yeah. And with its nice visible gears.
As sort of body kits were developed over the years, they were all developed for whatever was available at the time. So like in the 80s and the early 90s, it was the Ibotren chassis. Then you go through into the mid-90s to the early 2000s, it was what's known as the Backman white box chassis, which were, you know, cheap and cheerful, and you can get them everywhere. And then they've sort of gone out, and other things have come in and gone, like the Farish 08, the Kato tram chassis at the minute, because you can pretty much get them everywhere.
I mean, where would we be without the Farish 08?
Oh, that's my favourite chassis, I have to say. The new one, anyway.
yeah, with the lovely outside cranks. Finally!
Yes.
Someone makes a ready-to-run chassis with outside cranks. I mean, Fordy's based a whole business on it.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved with the society?
For me, it was, I mean, I've been modelling since I was 5 years old, and I've been a member of a club for quite a long time, and we started hosting joint shows with the local 009 area group at Christmas. I essentially got harangued into buying some 009 locos by one of the society members, Stan Williams, and just not look back. I've not been a member for that long, really, and I've not been modelling in 009 for that long, so I've managed to do quite a lot in quite a short space of time.
Whereas, Ben, you're an old hand at this. You've got your membership card from 2001.
Yes, that was when I first joined, at about the tender age of 16. And that, again, it was kind of fuelled by all the family holidays in Wales and things. The grandparents who were involved in the Welsh Highland, as it was at just, you know, the little one at Porthmadog. And then I sort of inherited/got given a box of 009 stuff from my uncle, and he was like, hey, you can do something with that. And it just took off from there, really. I mean, it did let the membership lapse for a few years, I think, when I was of the age when women and beer come first. But I've sort of been back in the society since probably about 2009, I think, now. I haven't let it lapse again, really.
Let's talk a bit more about the members space for what you get. So it's almost a bit like a swap meet kind of thing. It's an exclusive market that you get. You can get things cheaply. There's things that might be a bit rarer, for example. What other kind of stuff can you get as a member?
One of the, slightly more grisly aspect, shall we say, is given the general demographic, for want of a better word, of modellers, is a society can act as like an executor service. So occasionally you get like quite big collections that come in, people who've got some incredible models which have sort of not been squirreled away, but they come to the fore again, and there's some beautiful stuff that comes through. If you turn up at a show, anyone I think really can use the society sales, but then for the mail order stuff it is just members only. And with the advent of the new website, we're saying new, it's newish websites, all been revamped over the past year or so. Now it's actually got an online capability, so as long as you're a member you can actually buy stuff. Not, you can't peruse the whole selection of what's in members sales, because it sort of fills a whole garage. It's like thousands of items at any one time, really. But they always put like a selection of what they've got on the website, and you can buy it through there.
I think what you're saying about being the executor of an estate, in a way, it's one of the unfortunate realities of the hobby that people will collect stuff and then they pass away, and quite a lot of the time it'll go to the tip, which is really unfortunate. But it's really nice to be able to rehome those items with people who really care about them.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've personally got quite a few locos and things that have been acquired through the executor's function. They're locos that belonged to friends and people that were quite sort of instrumental early on, and they're now the most precious locos that I've got in the collection. It's always good to be able to pass things on to people that are going to look after them and use them and appreciate them.
Yeah, and it'd be horrible to let these things go to waste, or even just to go to, say, a shop or an auction house that doesn't really care about them, and it's just going to...
Yeah.
They go, oh, it's not Hornby, it must be some other rubbish, so we'll just move it on as soon as we can.
Yeah, it allows the person who's passed away or their families to have some control over where the prized belongings end up.
Mm. In non-pandemic times, what kind of physical meetups are possible with the society?
Your local area groups normally have monthly meetings. I know we certainly did in the West Midlands group. We sort of met the second Monday of every month. I think in total we've got something like 26 members who attended our meetings regularly. Hey, it's just nice, sort of tea and biscuits and talking about model trains. What more could you want of an evening?
I'm in the Merseyside and South West Lancs local area group. We tend to meet bi-monthly. And we hire a local church hall, and we will bring a layout, we'll bring whatever we've been working on that month, and again, tea and biscuits, chatting all day, pretty much Saturday from late morning to early evening, and we'll just have a nice chat. And I really miss it, to be honest, at the moment. It's just nice to be able to see what other people are up to.
And like-minded people as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that a lot of mixed groups can sometimes have problems where their interests don't really align, but with this, it's so much more focused.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of like, say, normal standard gauge railway modellers. There's, like, in that you have the people who are Great Western and the people who are LMS in 00, in sort of narrow gauge.
The tribes.
Yes. There's sort of a degree of that, but we're a bit less grating on each other in 009. Because, I mean, you've got people, like in the West Mids group, we've got people who model continental metre gauge, people who model Irish 3 foot, people who do like British industrial and also colonial stuff, like Garrett's and things. So there is still a broad spectrum of interest.
What you say there is actually really interesting, because this isn't just about 9mm track. So the society can cover more gauges than the standard 009 thing, despite the name. It's kind of an umbrella. So can you tell me a bit about that?
Basically, if it's 4mm or 3.5mm to the foot, and it runs on something narrower than 16.5mm gauge track, it falls under our umbrella. So that's basically everything from 6.5mm gauge, which sort of is representative of 18-inch, all the way up to, I think we've seen layouts in 16mm gauge. So technically that's 4 foot and it's still narrow gauge. So that covers, say, 12mm, 10mm and 9mm, and even the mad folk who scratch build the 8mm gauge track.
Is that 008, then?
Yes, that's actual true 2 foot gauge. I mean, majority of 009 models and layouts are of 2 foot gauge prototypes, but that if you get mathematical about it, 9mm gauge is 2'3", so it's exactly right for your Tallaght and your Corris tracks, but everything else it's not quite right, but we can sort of we let a mil slip here and there.
Well, I quite like having an elastic gauge. 6.5 is really interesting because is this quite a recent development? I know that I've seen, say, light railway stores have been making kits for 006.5. Is this based on the back of the Busch Feldbahn sets?
Yeah, I think it essentially started out as, is it HOF?
Yeah.
The Busch stuff tends to use their mechs. The light railway stores and Narrow Planet kits, they're all mixed media 3D prints with etches, usually nickel silver, and that, so they're literally state of the art, latest modelling tech.
And they are beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. It's sorely tempting, but I don't need any more scales. I really don't.
Exactly. I don't think I'm enough of a sadist masochist to put myself through having yet another one and also make it even smaller than 9mm gauge.
Yeah.
Let's look at the larger ones. So 12mm. This is, like you say, Irish 3-foot narrow gauge. I mean, that's a whole host of prototypes that you can cover as well.
Yeah, it's a massive, massive world of modelling.
And if you want to do something like that, where do you get started? Because obviously there's the great thing about having N-gauge track and N-gauge mechanisms is that the standard gauge chassis are available from Graham Farish for a lot of the time and Backman, and also from other manufacturers. But what can you do about if you want to do 3-foot gauge in 176 scale?
I think most people will they start in that. They'd get hold of the old Triang TT mechanisms because that was all 12mm gauge, and it kind of, that's the starting point. Backwards Miniatures, when they were still trading, I'm sure did a couple of kits in which could be built to true 12mm gauge. And Branch Lines as well, they do actually do the Isle of Man 3-foot stuff, and they actually do a chassis to go with it, so that's like the complete locomotive in one kit. I mean, there's plenty of places that will do the rolling stock as well, or something, you know, based on the rolling stock.
One of the society kits, the cattle van, is a Trillian Dingle cattle van, and that can be built to 12mm gauge, I think, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
And this is using TT scale track?
Pretty much. It's the same gauge. Pico do make 12mm gauge track now for...
Excellent.
Yeah. I don't know how long they've been making it, Ben.
Not a clue, but I know it's definitely out there. I mean, I'm sure they've even branched into 10mm as well. I could be wrong about that one, but I know I've seen it somewhere.
So would that be 2'6", say, Welshbourne Camphor?
Yeah, but that's sort of based on a European sort of series. They call it HOM, I think, which it's known in Europe, and that's like the bigger, like 760mm gauge lines, things like the Harts, places like that, where you get supersized narrow gauge engines with 10 couple tank engines.
Things that look as big as a 9F but running on tiny, tiny tracks.
Yes.
With all these scales and gauges, it can get a bit confusing. There seems to be a European naming convention because it's based around HO, and then the British naming convention because it's based around 00. What are the equivalents? Say if you wanted to get a mechanism or track easily and cheaply. So I think you said that HOF was 006.5, so you'd use the mechanisms from those. Those are the two equivalent sort of gauges. What are the other ones?
HOM, that is mainly catered for in Europe, and I think it's BMO and Pico do the chassis in that sort of size, but they're quite expensive as well, but they're made sort of, the engineering in them is incredible. I mean, your 12mm stuff, again, old second-hand Triang, and I think there are, again, a couple of manufacturers. I think BMO do what equates as 12mm stuff. I could be wrong on that one. I suppose it's scratch building.
I mean, there's always scratch building.
Yeah.
There's really, really crazy people. I think a lot of people found the Backman WD Baldwin too tempting.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that was definitely, it's paid off for them. That must have paid for itself by now.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a superb model. I've got two. And it's not even sort of my thing that I would model, but it's a superb model, and it wasn't a bad price either. So people have just, I think they've flown off the shelves, to be honest.
Tell me a bit about your personal experiences with 009. Why did you get into narrow gauge? Where did that start for you? And why did you keep at it?
I suppose, yeah, it was the holidays in Wales, you know, and it's seeing the little engines, and you know, I've been to place when I was little again, you know, right around by Birmingham, it's Severn Valley Railway's kind of the big one, and then the Great Central. And so you see the big engines, and then we go to Wales and you see all these little engines. It's like, well, that's weird. The wheels are on the inside. Look at this one. Everything's moved around. And it was just so much more interesting, I suppose, to me, personally to me. There's such a variety. I mean, it's not like you go somewhere and go, oh, that's a class 5 on the narrow gauge. You know, there's although there were standard classes, there's just not as prolific as sort of your mainline modelling. And it was just, the compactness of it all, which kind of appealed to me. And then it's just like anything, really. You go, as you're going through it and explore it and investigate more, you find the things that sort of appeal to you even more. I mean, I've got loads of sort of industrial album books at home, and you know, it's just great flicking through those. But then also you find out it wasn't just the Vestiniog and the Tyth Lynn. I mean, there, you know, there was the industrial lines that got everywhere.
Well, in the days before JCBs and forklift trucks and stuff, you'd have to use rails to move heavy loads over construction sites and things like that.
Yeah,
and obviously those have all disappeared now.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think in research, doing a bit of research in my last layout that I built, I actually found that there was a narrow gauge line not too far from where I grew up. Obviously, it had long gone by then, but yeah, it ran in a quarry. Funnily enough, it had what was essentially a quarry Hunslet, but it was on 3-foot gauge. And then there was also a couple other quarry lines in the vicinity of it, and that was all found through looking around and trying to and researching. And it just opens up more and more worlds for you to investigate
down the rabbit hole.
Hmm.
How about you, Rob?
I'm very good at falling down rabbit holes. As Ben says, it's probably a familiar story for a lot of people in the society. It all starts with family holidays. I mean, we spent a lot of time in Wales, but even going around England and things like that, we were always sort of drawn to the more quirky railways, the narrow gauge railways, the miniature railways. We holidayed in Wales quite regularly. And by the time I got to sort of 17, I was looking for something to do. So I volunteered on the Vestiniog and Welsh Island, and found the South African 2-foot gauge railways and just sort of never looked back, because up until then my modelling had been sort of BR sectorisation.
Well, that's so quite a step change.
It is quite a hell of a step change. finding these big behemoths of locos running on 2-foot gauge through a place that was sort of British but different enough. You know, you had sort of British practice, but in a place that was much warmer. I just fell in love with it, and that was where it went for me. Like I say, the fact that our club started running these joint shows with the society area group, it was a no-brainer, really.
So how have you achieved that? Is it, have you gone down the backwards kits route?
I've got a couple of backwards kits, none that I've built myself, because I can't pluck up the courage to actually try one. I can
well,
build.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because they're so rare now.
Exactly.
It takes a lot of guts to actually get stuck into one.
Exactly.
And I think that because you know you're not going to be able to just get another.
Yeah, I bought two that were ready built, and I've bought one as a kit, and it's currently being built for me, which is really bad because I feel like I'm just checkbook modelling. But I know I can build white metal kits and things like that, plastic kits. It's just those backwards ones. The motion on them just looks terrifying. So.
I don't think you should feel bad about it. I mean, when I first came back into modelling, I was so scared about painting models, I paid somebody else to do it for me, because I didn't know where to start with it. And I didn't have, once I'd done all this work on the model, I didn't want to then like sort of scupper it by doing a lash-up paint job on it. And then seeing that being done then gave me the confidence to actually do it.
Yeah. I think that there are several areas of modelling that people would regard as dark arts. Soldering being one of them, and painting being another.
Everyone who does it says, oh, it's not that bad. You know, yeah. You just got to get started, and it's like, but it's scary.
You've just got to have a go. Exactly.
Gosh, got to have a go, they say. Oh.
Yes, you do.
I'm quite happy to paint things, but sit me down with some brass, and I just wouldn't have a clue. Whereas Ben, you're really good at building things in brass. It's different strokes for different folks. You should never, I think, try and be a master of everything. You should just always try and do what you're good at.
Yeah, that's actually something which was a benefit of the society, because my first brass soldering lesson was with someone from our local group, because I'd actually picked up one of the little backwards miniatures. They called it the beginner series. I think it was little Andrew Barclay side tank, a contractor's loco. That was one of those things, oh, I can do this. Opened the lid and went, oh, can't do that. But someone from our group went, no, I'll set you up with it. Well, you know, I'll give you soldering lessons. And you kind of, the advantage of it sort of almost was that because it was almost like an engine of two halves. So he did one side tank to show me how it was done, and I did the other side tank, and then he did one cylinder and I did the other cylinder, and he sort of soldered half the chassis and I soldered the other half of the chassis. And it was really good learning like that, because it's not just someone doing it and then telling you, well, I did this. I was actually having a go as well, and I could see how it was done and then try it. And that for me was the best way of learning. But yeah, I think the other piece of advice that I was given about brass soldering was, don't expect to get it right first time. Which sounds a bit pessimistic, but if it doesn't go right, you kind of go, well, never mind. But if it does go right, you go, oh, brilliant, I'll have another go.
I think that's something that we touched on in the episode when I spoke with Maggie Gravett about getting kids into modelling, and how it's quite hard sometimes because they can make an image in their mind and then they get frustrated when they don't achieve it. And I think it's almost getting used to, not failure, but, you know, getting it wrong. It's getting used to getting it wrong, going, well, how can I learn from this? And how can I adapt and then move on, and not to just sort of throw it all out and go, ah, no point anymore. Hard with a backwards kit to do that.
So I've plenty of times I've wanted to throw something across the room because I'm frustrated with it.
I mean, at least if it's brass, you can hammer it back into shape.
Well, yeah. Or it just gets painted in rust colours and left on the scrap pile on your layout.
Absolutely. You can always change it into scenery. That's the main thing. Ben, where does your interests lie at the moment? What are you modelling at the moment?
UK industrial, sort of like factory and industrial site railways. Sort of think things like the Woolwich Arsenal, Guinness Brewery and all those kind of places where it's sort of small, generally small locomotives and sort of tight curves, you know, just shuffling around with one or two wagons here and there, but there's constant movement. I mean, sort of the impetus for my current layout that I'm building was actually, again, going back to one of these industrial albums, it was just seeing a picture of a little four-coupled Peckett saddle tank from a steelworks in Sheffield. And it was one of those, oh, I like that. And so I ended up building two of them because I'd managed to get hold of the drawings. And then it was sort of, well, I need a layout for that. And so it's germinated into actually building a whole industrial layout now.
All from one photo.
Yeah, but no passengers and platforms and coaches to worry about. It's just wagons.
This reminds me a little bit about something you were saying earlier about them having different characteristics, because I mean, with the larger companies, especially after the Big Four, it kind of, you know, all became a bit, not samey, but you know, you're very obviously in a certain country's area. Whereas with the narrow gauge stuff, because they were all their own companies, they tended to have their own identities. They're like a Festiniog loco doesn't look like a Linton and Barnstaple loco at all, because they're just from completely different families, but they look alike. You know, they look like they're from the same family because they use the same fittings and fixtures on their own railways. And you can get that even down to the industrial level. You mentioned the Guinness Brewery locos. It's so unusual compared to some of the bigger stuff.
It's sort of narrow gauge is a bit of an odd mix in that respect, because half of the engines were built for that purpose, like the Guinness Brewery locos, and the rest were standard stock items which would fit. Again, like the Manning Wardles and Linton and Barnstaple were built for that, as were the Festiniog Double Fairleys. But then if you look at everywhere else, Quarry Hunslets, it was developed for the quarries, but then that became a standard loco because it was just so versatile. So that you did find them out and about in other places. Not very many, but they did get around. They were sort of the smaller contractors things were more sort of proliferated by Bagnalls and Kerr Stewarts and people like that.
But that makes it more exciting that the new Quarry Hunslet ready-to-run model is coming out soon.
Yes, there's a lot of people excited for that.
I think everyone's going to have to get one. I mean, if it's going to be anything like, you know, the Hornby Peckett was for 00.
Oh, wonderful engine.
Yeah. And great chassis donor as well. What do you find that people who are coming into 009 find as a stumbling block? And how do you get them to get past it? Is it mechanisms?
Yeah, most of the time. It's mechanisms and going back to having a go at something.
Is that because classically there's been a lot less available in 009 ready to run, that you can't just go to your local model shop and go, well, I'll have that and that, and then that's done? A lot of it does involve building stuff, especially if you want to achieve, you know, the stock that you want, for example, carriages and wagons and stuff. Because now that we've got more ready to run locos, there's still a lot of kits available. I mean, there's still all the kits available that used to be. So is it that element of having to get stuck in and building stuff that you find is a stumbling block for people?
Yeah, and I'd also say, as you just mentioned about the Hornby Peckett, because a lot of the chassis come from Engage locos, a lot of people will sort of think to themselves, or say it out loud a lot of the time. I can't pull that apart just for the chassis. I can't take that Graham Farish 08 apart just for the chassis. And it gets even worse when you figure that the 08 can be used as a sort of kit of parts to make everything from an 04 out to a 10 coupled chassis. And people are thinking, I can't start cutting that chassis up. Never mind taking the loco apart, but cutting it up as well. It takes a lot. It takes a lot of guts to take a razor saw to something like that.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think I remember reading something from 4Ds about Backman wouldn't sell them just the chassis. So you have to buy the entire loco and then throw half of it on the scrap heap.
Yeah.
Or in the recycling, I guess.
Which is wounding. One of our fellow committee members said in a discussion a couple of weeks ago, he suspects that somewhere in 4D's HQ, there is a large cupboard full of 08 bodies, just dismembered bodies.
Yes, I can believe it. Either that or they make furniture out of them. Is there anything else that you find that people find difficult to get to grips with when they're moving into narrow gauge?
I don't know if getting to grips with, apart from, like we've already mentioned, the kit building and everything, but once you know, it's taking it in baby steps, and I think it's sort of, I don't know, I suppose, working out what narrow gauge is for, really, because now, you know, it's like we've said previously, people get introduced to it on the Festiniog or wherever, and then it's sort of showing that, no, well, actually, it's not how it was. You know, this, it used to be for just freight only. I mean, a passenger-carrying narrow gauge railway was very rare back in the day.
I remember I was reading about the Corris Railway and reading about how, you know, they'd unofficially been carrying passengers for years before they actually got permission to do it properly, and it was always kind of a little bit not written down, but a bit anecdotal about people saying, oh yeah, no, you just catch the train back. It's like, oh, it's a gravity slate train, you're just gonna hitch a lift on it back home. I mean, hell of a ride.
Yeah, sounds perfect to me.
But no, you're right about, like, saying what's it for. It'd be a bit strange to just replicate mainline operation.
Yeah, it's sort of, again, unless you're modeling sort of European stuff, like, you know, you're doing a model of the Harts or sort of something along those lines. There's no sort of such thing in inverted commas as mainline operation in narrow gauge.
A lot of it's centred around industrial operations, which are mostly involve a lot of shunting. Is that possible in 009 because of its small scale? I mean, how does one achieve that?
The old saying, cleanliness is next to godliness. Nice clean track, nice sort of smooth track, as it were, and just keeping the mechanisms clean and fluff free. I mean, you know, more wheels is more pickup, and that's always a good start. But it is achievable. I mean, I'm on my engines, although they're all four coupled, where I've got a pony truck, I've added pickups to the pony truck, so it's still got six wheel pickup, so that helps going over points and crossings and things. And weight.
And what about in terms of couplings? Like, how does that? Is there a standard of couplings in 009?
That is a very good question.
Well, I came to the right people.
I think you'll find the vast majority of people use the BMO style coupler.
So this is a large buffing plate in the middle with a little pointy bit sticking up out of the top, and then a hook, a loop of wire sort of fits over the top of that pointy up bit.
Yeah, that's the one. And you can get it from various different manufacturers. Now, there's still BMO, there's Greenwich, who make etched brass versions, which are quite small and dainty and good for a more fine scale look, and you can get the Pico ones as well now. So I'd say that's probably the closest you'll get to a standard. There's various different options. There's people that use standard N-gauge couplers, there's people that use microace couplers, things like KDs, but I'd say the BMO is probably the closest you'll get.
And how is that to live with? So, I mean, obviously 00 gauge comes with tension lockers standard, but a lot of people use KDs and things like that for the remote uncoupling that it offers. But what can you do with the Greenwich style, BMO style couplers to make them able to be used in like an industrial setting where you're doing a lot of shunting?
They're not bad at all, to be honest. I mean, you'll find a lot of people will remove the loop from one end of each wagon or loco, and they can be set up for automatic uncoupling. The Greenwich ones quite easily. The BMO ones, to be fair, tend to work with the Greenwich automatic uncouplings done with magnets, and the BMO ones I've found that they respond to the same magnets as well, so it's quite easy to set up, really. There's no, as long as everything is the same height, you shouldn't really have any issue at all,
which is standard for any scale, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Pico also do an uncoupling ramp that sort of acts with their couplers, and that will also work the same for the BMO couplers in particular. And again, it's just like a little, it's a movable plastic ramp that nestles in the sleepers between the rails, and you can just lift it and lower it as you need, or have it set at a permanent height to to as something pushes over, it'll uncouple.
Obviously, we're dealing with locos and stock that is a lot smaller. Is there much take-up of DCC operation in order to get chips and sound and things like that in, all those new gadgets that people love so much?
It can be done. Again, it very much depends on the model you've got. I mean, like the
Well, Batman. If you've got a Garrett, it's probably a little bit easier. But if you've got a Quarry Hunslet, probably a little bit harder.
Yeah. I believe Backman have made the Quarry Hunslet. It's got provisions for DCC, which is mind-boggling, if I'm honest, given that how small it is in 009. But if they've managed it, then more than fair play to them.
You'd be surprised as well. I wouldn't like to try and fit a decoder into an NGG-16. There's not a lot of space inside that backwards kit.
Yeah, fair point. Are we ever going to see a ready-to-run NGG-16?
I hope so. It's very Ben. Much on my wish list.
Ben, you've got the inside line.
Pass is the honest answer. I think, I don't know, it's one of those things that always pops up on a wish list. But actually talking to a manufacturer once, just sort of casually at a show, this was a few years ago now, he sort of estimated that a starting price for a ready-to-run NG-16 would be in the region of £250 starting, and then it'd go up. You know, you look at the cost of the Hellion Linton and Barnstaple engines. No, they're in the high hundreds to 200s mark. So it's not totally unfeasible, but then probably it would still be quite expensive. And again, it depends on how much the uptake would be. I mean, although they're a popular engine, not everyone would want to model like South African or the Welsh Highland with Garretts. So it's one of those. I mean, I think we're fortunate to be getting what we're getting at the minute. I mean, if someone does come out with a ready-to-run NG-16, then that would be amazing.
It'll be really interesting to see how the double fairlies get on, because I know that they've been mooted after the Small England's come out. Because yes. You're essentially looking at a similar operation where it's, you know, you're getting twice the loco, and what kind of prices they're going to come out at and what kind of uptake there's going to be.
Well, there's been a lot of positive feedback for the England's and the double fairlies, to be honest. I mean, the sort of the double fairly you can get away with a bit easier because it's basically like a bogey diesel chassis. Essentially, because of the way it articulates, it's different to the Garrett. We, as the society, were quite fortunate because we had a meeting with Mr. Cato at Worley a couple of years back when it was sort of first announced, and he was really keen on sort of getting the society's input into the development of these models, sort of saying, you know, what do people want from them, you know, because he didn't want to make a model that people would go, well, we don't want that, we want this feature and this feature. And he was sort of really enthusiastic to get our feedback to help develop the model to make it absolutely something someone would want.
It's a problem I think the manufacturers have in 009 is even amongst relatively similar looking fleets, such as the double fairlies, there's such a huge amount of variety in detail differences. Even an NGG-16, there were, 150-odd of them, and they were built in so many different batches that they're all different, pretty much. Developing a ready-to-run loco in 009 is not an easy task by any stretch of the imagination. As Ben says, to have what we've got at the moment is definitely worth celebrating.
Absolutely. One of the things that came up in the previous episode was that the freedom of inventing your own railway and freelance modelling seems to be much bigger in 009 and narrow gauge modelling in general. There's an idea that people are more willing to experiment a bit. Is that what you find? Do you find... What's the ratio, do you think, of people modelling real locations and based on real locations, but slightly fictionalised, and then fully freelance models?
I'd say it's majoritively fictional models of what we see out there. And the people, it falls more into three sort of categories. You've got completely freelance, then based on, in the style of, so like people will model bits of the Welsh Pool or Tad Lynn, but because of size constraints, they'll like say, you know, it's not to scale, so they'll do like a condensed version of Towin Wharf or something. And then you've got the people who do the exact scale models and, you know, every tree's in the right spot. But yeah, so it's probably freelance and based on are the two most popular styles, should we say.
I know that a lot of people like to model sort of a fictitious branch off one of the main ones. I think if they all lived in a shared universe, I think the Festiniog would have the most branch lines out of any narrow gauge line I've ever seen.
Yeah, it'd probably cover most of Wales, to be honest.
If only. Do you think this is going to change, or do you think that what I mean is with the introduction of more ready to run stuff and like we say, like whole fleets of a single railway, do you think that there's going to be less in terms of freelance modelling, like the true freelance modelling, as in make it all up, and more in terms of the semi based on a real location or replicating real locations?
I think it depends on how the manufacturers, what route they go down. I mean, Helgen, for example, the new Linton and Barnstaple Baldwin Lynn, they're bringing that out in a plain black livery, which I don't think it ever wore in service. I think it was delivered in green.
Which, interestingly, it's almost the opposite of what Backman had done with the WD, where they've put it in a freelance Southern Railway livery.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's almost Helgen are going the opposite way.
Yeah, but both sort of methods, both ways of doing it, allow people to be more creative with where the locos turn up. I mean, I've pre-ordered a Baldwin for use on my colonial layout, and I don't think it'll look out of place. It will look just as at home as it would on a Linton and Barnstaple layout, which I think is a really good way of selling more locos, to be honest, for the manufacturers. And I think it's a really useful thing for us as modellers to be able to use different... It allows us to carry on that freelance modelling that does attract so many people to the society.
Because I guess one of the concerns would be that more prototypes being covered accurately would kind of lead to, not the death, but a real sort of decrease in popularity of the freelance imaginative style, which I think would be a real shame, really. But actually, if the manufacturers are getting behind it and saying, well, you know, this is for any layout, this can go on anything, then it opens more doors to people.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would diminish the idea of the freelance layouts. I mean, you've seen there are plenty of layouts out there which will run like Festiniog engines next to Tatlin engines next to NG16s, because ultimately rule one prevails, I suppose. You know, if it's their railway and they run what they're happy with. I think, if anything, it might encourage more, let's say, sort of actual railway layouts, you know, with if you've got like the whole availability of the Linton Barnstaple fleet and rolling stock, we might see more true Linton Barnstaple layouts. With the model rail Vale of Rydal 262 that's coming out, hopefully this year, maybe, that might see a surge in Vale of Rydal layouts. You never know.
And I think people do buy things. I mean, this is true of any scale, though, but just because they look nice, because they look irresistible.
Yeah.
And also, like, say, you know, holidays from your childhood have such a big impact on you. You say, well, I rode the Vale of Rydal when I was little, and it's got such a nice place in my memories that I really want to own a model of one of the locos. I think because these railways have existed as tourist railways for so long and have been so successful at it, that's how a lot of people remember them.
Yeah, I've
not really a question, is it?
I know I've certainly got a couple of models of locomotives that I've ridden behind, or even crewed, because I do the volunteering on the 12 inches to the foot scale as well. And yeah, it's quite nice actually to have a model, and you say, I've driven that in real life, and I've got my own version now.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sorely tempted by a Backman Quarry Hunslet, particularly Britomart, because having once witnessed very small loco pull an entire 10-car Welsh Highland rake out of Harbour Station and not miss a beat, I think it's worth having on any layout.
I mean, that's a hell of a performance.
It really was.
They're tough. For anybody who's looking to get into 009, where would you say they start?
I would say joining the society, to be honest. I think that is the perfect
smooth.
it's as I said earlier, that there's such a wealth of information, you would have to try really hard to go in the wrong direction. There is always somebody who can help you. There is always inspiration. We've got our monthly magazine, the News. There is always something inspiring in there. So I think that would probably be your first port of call. But just having a go, as with anything. Buy a kit and glue it together, see where you end up.
What kit would you recommend for a beginner?
Yeah, there's plenty of simple, easy-to-do kits out there, like a four-wheel open wagon, kind of like the ones we produce in the 009 Society.
Smooth.
Yeah. Which, it's a base, two sides, two ends, two sole bars, and a pair of axles. You know, you can't really go wrong with that.
It's also made out of that really nice plastic that glues well.
Yes,
it does.
I think that's the key thing for me, is that tactile plastic, when you think, this is going to stay stuck together.
Yes.
And what are the opportunities there in terms of developing technologies like 3D printing?
That's definitely expanded over the past few years. I think it's nice that the things are starting to develop in the more in the forms of the mixed media kits. So you have like a 3D printed superstructure with an etched overlay. It kind of means you don't have to spend quite as much time cleaning up the layers on a 3D print. But in saying that as well, the quality of the 3D printers that are coming out now means you don't always have to clean up. They're smooth from the off, which is always nice.
Hopefully we'll see more of that coming online soon.
It does seem to be the future from what I can see. It's becoming such a big thing, and that there are 3D printed locos out there to cater for any sort of skill level. So as Ben says, the mixed media kits, they're a little bit more complicated because of the etches and things like that. But if you go on Shapeways, there are so many people who are designing locos, even that will just sit on the Kato chassis and make a lovely little tram style loco.
Well, I think the Kato chassis is the starting point for so many people in W9.
Yeah, absolutely.
No fiddly valve gear to worry about. You just plonk it on and it goes straight away.
Yeah, exactly. And if we'd had the running quality of the Kato chassis 20 years ago, it would have been so welcomed. They run so well, especially even the new ones that have just come out, the new coreless ones, they're so smooth. It's unbelievable.
Just echoing what Rob said, you know, Shapeways is an absolute sort of wealth of 009 stock locomotives, you know, anything really. And it's not always just a single piece 3D printed body that clips onto a chassis. You know, there are them out there which you do have to do a degree of assembly to, but also you can use them as a basis and sort of build your own engines around it. You know, I've got some 3D printed engines which are kind of more of a scratch aid, you know, and I had to make the cab for it, but then I also modified the chassis to better represent the actual prototype. You know, and it's as long as you're careful with 3D print, I mean, they can be quite brittle, but they are kind of good starting points if you want to modify it.
Yeah, and it's not too expensive.
No.
I mean, actually getting the print and stuff is, but if you can use services where they print it for you, and the actual resin and stuff doesn't cost that much. So even if you can afford a home printer, the doors that opens for you can be huge.
Absolutely. I've always found that the biggest cost with the likes of Shapeways is the postage cost, because it comes from the Netherlands. The actual logos and kits and things are usually really reasonably priced. And there are, as we sort of touched on earlier, there are more people who are now doing it at home using the resin printers.
And I think that the resin printers at home can be far superior quality to the Shapeways ones. Even I mean, yeah. It's even like Shapeways was a jump up in terms of quality of what could be achieved, and then there's like a leap again on top of that, and you can get it from something you can have on your desk.
Yeah, absolutely. The resin printers are out of this world, to be honest. So much so, I've bought one. I've not set it up yet. I've not used it, but I have bought one. I just think it's going to be such a huge advantage to my toolkit, my skill set. They're just brilliant. It's definitely the future.
Ben, as a brass kit builder, how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't know about brass. I'm a bit more of a scratch builder, to be honest. I mean, it's each to their own, really. I'm not going to hate anyone for 3D printing, because I mean, I can't use CAD programs. So, you know, if CAD is and the 3D printer is your toolkit, then carry on. You know, I prefer brass. But it's just me. You know, I've done metalworking and machining as trades anyway, so that's my skill set, and I know what I'm doing there.
I think so many people who do try out brass say they'll never build anything else.
It is nice. It's a nice material to work with. It's got the strength while also being sort of quite thin. You know, you can be using 0.2 mil sheet for stuff, and you know, something you could fold up as a sheet, but then when it's constructed, it's actually nice and rigid. It's a bit more, it's more forgiving than plastic, but I think when you're doing plastic, because that's how I started scratch building, you know, it's only one too many strokes of the file and you've taken out too much and you start again, whereas brass, you've got almost a finer degree of control with it. So it's, I'm not going to say it's less difficult to mess up, but it's just the natural evolution. You know, you kind of, if you're going along the scratch building route and making it all yourself, you kind of go through plastic and into brass and whatever, and you kind of just, you learn as you're going along.
What kind of tips would you give to someone who's like wanting to get, maybe they've got a 00 layout already and they want to get started in the narrow gauge. Like we said earlier, some people might want to have like a narrow gauge addition to them. Is there a certain manufacturer you go to for track? Is there something that's easier to you than other people's stuff?
Pico, I suppose, is the first and only port of call for track, really. I mean, they do everything that you need. So recently, over the past few years, reintroduced their set track into 009, so you've got the 9-inch radius curves and points for more confined spaces. But then they also do the bigger stuff like 12 and 18-inch mainline points.
So you're getting as many options as you get in the standard gauge track, really.
Yeah.
Because I remember the crazy track days, and I remember it being like, if you wanted any different radius point, you had to go to an N-gauge point and adjust the sleeper spacing yourself. But that seems to have changed.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty as well, as the Pico 009 track, it's fully compatible with Pico N-gauge track. So if you do want something like a curved point or a crossover or double slips even, you know, you can just plug an N-gauge one in. Again, modify the sleeper spacings, but it'll work because it's all just connects together nicely.
And then which RTR loco should they buy, in your opinion?
Well, they've only got a choice of two at the minute. I suppose a starting point would actually be mini trains. They've got quite a good range, and I'd say they are they're the cheapest of the current ready to run stuff. It's not strictly speaking 009. The company admits that it's sort of like it floats between 4mm and 3.5mm scale. But nothing really looks out of place. And it's sort of, even though it's the cheapest of the ready-to-run stuff, it doesn't mean that it's of a lesser quality. I mean, the mini-train stuff comes with a flywheel as standard, and it generally runs beautifully.
They're also a really good starting point if you want to tinker. So if you want to repaint or you want to add detail, they're a really good place to start with things like that. I mean, there's the mini trains, Fiddletown and Copperopolis Tenderloco, which is an American 040 Tenderloco, and it has become probably the standard 040 chassis. So there are so many kits that fit on that chassis, but there are also so many people, again, on Shapeways and other places that now supply different cabs, different cow catchers, different domes, different funnels. There's so many possibilities with mini trains locos.
I've got a couple of them in the drawer above my head right now. Quite hard to find at the moment. I don't know why. I don't know if it's interruptions because of the pandemic or because of Brexit, but it's quite hard to find them in the UK.
It's I think mini trains run on batch production, so they'll do, you know, a run of this engine, and then they'll do a run of the next model and a run of the next model, and if there's demand, they'll go back to that original one.
Well, I ended up going to Mini Trains directly and emailed them about it, and they sold me the last two they had in stock. So sorry, everybody. If you can't find one, it's my fault.
There's always eBay.
Well, hopefully we'll see another batch come through. Yes. I mean, there's always eBay. Hopefully they'll come through with another batch anyway.
Yeah. I mean, they're still developing new models as well, which is quite refreshing, actually. I mean, they're sort of every sort of 2 years or so, there's new Mini Train stuff that comes out. So they've definitely, you know, there's a good variety of stuff available from there as well.
And as you say, with them being so cheap, you don't feel too bad about chopping into them or using them as a donor for chassis and things like that.
No.
If someone wants to find out about the 009 Society or wants to join, where should they go?
The website, which is 009society.com. It's probably your first protocol. You'll find all the information for joining. You'll also find all of our email addresses and things if you want to ask any more questions.
I joined the other day and it was really easy. I mean, I could pay online, no phone card, like check payments or anything else like that. It was straight through, got an email straight away about it, and then got my membership card in the post a couple of days later.
Yeah, we try and make it as painless as possible.
And a free kit.
And a free kit.
Excellent.
Plus, while you're waiting for your membership stuff to come through, you can go back on the website and look at the gallery of models and things like that and members' layouts and gain loads of inspiration.
I was straight on the shop. Straight away browsing the bargains in the shop. But that's me. Okay, well, thanks, guys, for coming on the show. I hope we get some more sign-ups to it because I really want this area of the hobby to continue to grow.
So do we.
Yep.
Any final words on 009?
It's brilliant. Just do it.
Do it.
Have a go.
Yeah, do it.
Just do it. Excellent. Thanks again. Hopefully I'll speak to you again soon.